Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. And hopefully this is Jeff calling in on the line. This is the personal wealth coach. If this is you on the air, go ahead.
I'm on the air.
All right. There you go.
How do I sound?
You sound a little echoey.
Okay. Let me see if I can fix that.
Okay. So this is Jeff and Jake McClure, and we are the personal wealth coach. We are also not coincidentally, the principals at a firm called the Personal Wealth Coach that's an SEC-registered investment advisory firm that gives fiduciary advice on how to invest and manage your budget and talks about finance in general to people of high net worth. We give fiduciary advice off the air, though. On the air, we give education. That is a big distinction and one that we need to make very clear. I wish it were clearer for the world in general that you can't give fiduciary advice on the air except in very, very, very broad terms. So what we do is give education and tell people what to look for and what to be aware of going on in the world and what to be aware of that might be happening later. We don't pay for this radio program. We do pay for advertising on the radio station, but we use that advertising to advertise for the radio program. How's that for weird? The station also advertises the radio program. So
they don't pay us.
And they don't pay us. We don't pay them. So that is our relationship, and if you can figure it out, you'll be ahead of us. We're doing this, and we've been doing this a long time, because people, if we ever threaten to stop, people have minor revolts and throw strange vegetables at us. We prefer not to, unless we're really hungry.
Now, I think we've been doing.
What was that?
We've been doing this for 24 years. I think we've been doing this for 24 years.
24. Let's see. You started
in
97. You did it in 97. I joined you in 98.
I actually found a tape from 1996.
Yeah, you did a half-hour program in 96. That's right. And then you went to 1 hour in 97 and 2 hours in 98. And that's when you said you needed somebody else on the air with you. So I joined you.
Yeah. So we are 24 years of forecasting the future, forecasting the past.
Great historical past casters.
Past casters, that's what we could be.
We're not forecasters. We're definitely past casters. We do occasionally make forecasts. So you had something.
Sometimes we make five casts.
Yes, you've been going back listening to radio programs since, what, 98? Is that what you were saying on the way here? We talked on the phone on my way to the studio.
Yeah, and I think, just to give us a little credibility, we're going to talk about what happens on the other side of this crisis, because it's a lot more pleasant to talk about what happens on the other side of the crisis than it is to talk about the crisis.
Right.
Although we'll talk about the crisis, too, because everybody else is, and we want to be in style.
Yeah.
But we've been around a long time, and we've made some interesting forecasts. Back in the 2000 through 2002, ancient bear market and recession, which...
What? They had those back then? What are you talking about?
We were forecasting something, and we enjoyed talking about something that I thought was pretty interesting. We said that Amazon and other digital online systems were going to be the retail of the future, and it was going to dominate the retail market.
And at the time,
when we said that,
the number one place to go shopping was the mall.
And Macy's was still going strong and was a very, very healthy company, and it just got removed from the S&P 500. The Macy's Christmas parade was still Thanksgiving parade, and the big Christmas celebration was still a big thing because they were rolling in money. And Macy's may not survive this event, but Amazon is just hired. I think they've hired 80,000 people so far with the goal of hiring 150,000 more workers.
Yeah.
They're hiring extra workers, 150,000. Macy's is shocked and dismayed that they had to lay off 125,000 people.
Yeah.
Which tells you the difference in size between what was the largest department store in the United States. Sears is bankrupt, I think, again.
Yeah.
For the third time.
Yeah. What we're saying here is that this is one of the final transitions over to a move away from the retail and toward a different kind of retail, toward online retail. And people say retail is dead, and I invite them to look at how Amazon does its sales. It's through retail vendors. It's just online versus in person. That's a shift that we've been calling for 20 plus years now, at a time when it was not the most popular thing to call for. And people were saying, oh no, nobody's going to trust the internet to buy their stuff on. You have to put your credit card information in there. And convenience supersedes that to some extent. Now what are we saying about the future now?
It takes a crisis for us to change things in the United States. Actually, it takes a crisis for people to change things anywhere. And we got our crisis, and we got a big one. And it's going to change just about everything that has anything to do with what we're doing in the United States. I mean, I was telling Jake on the way, so we were driving on the way, and he was driving on the way in. I was digitally riding with him. That I lay around at night when I wake up in the middle of the night, thinking about all the changes that this crisis, this coronavirus event is going to create in the economy and in the whole system that we work in the United States and in the world. And every time I think I've got it pretty much laid out, new things start popping into my mind. And there's little things and big things, and it starts cascading off in different directions. The one thing I can say that I'm very confident of is following this crisis, very little will be the same as it was before.
Right. I've got email questions from on the subject from during the week of what do we see the first shifts being coming out of this. And number one thing is I believe that we're going to have a biotech revolution. There are a lot of people scrutinizing the medical system, and as long as we could say if it ain't broke, don't fix it, even though it was kind of crumbling and falling apart, it was decaying a little bit, but it still ran. As long as if it ain't broke, don't fix it was the prevalent term, then you would have, when an engineer got sick, he'd go to the hospital and not look under the cover of what was running the ventilators or the heart monitors or the defibrillators and think he's in good hands. But a lot of that technology is very old. It's been minorly updated, and it's not had there's been no great incentive to update it. It works. Well, this is something, you know, you may appreciate this. I've been doing some research on prices of ventilator and prices of heart monitor defibrillators. They run between $30,000 and $35,000 a piece new. So it's the price of a new car. It's got this is the thing that we've learned when Dyson has redesigned the ventilator. Dyson, the vacuum cleaner company in the UK, they redesigned it, and they redesigned it in a way that would make it more quality, more efficient, and far less expensive. Extremely less expensive than $35,000 or $30,000 for a ventilator, because it's got a vacuum cleaner pump in it. And it's not like suddenly this is a new pump that we're putting in there. It's the same pump that was in there before. But it's being bought from a vacuum cleaner company instead of someone custom making it for a ventilator. And so we're going to see that stuff is going to change drastically coming out of this. There are a lot of people that this is what happens in crises. We have a lot of red tape on how to get into the healthcare world. That healthcare gets cleared away by a crisis and opens up the marketplace to a lot of innovation. And I expect to see that. We've essentially been flat for our life expectancy for the last 15 years. I expect to see that change. What do you see coming out of this?
One of the things I see is that I'm going to admit to a degree of ignorance, a degree of I don't know, because I don't think anybody would have predicted that the Great Depression of the Forgotten Depression, it's called, of 1920-21, would have resulted in automobiles going from being handmade, individual parts made separately for the very rich, to being mass produced so that everybody could have a car. And it was, but Henry Ford was out of work in 1920 and 21, and so he invented the mass produced automobile engine,
right,
and vehicle, and began to mass produce automobiles into the 1920s.
That was
so
not
that
something
everybody could have an automobile.
Right, that was not something that was easily predicted at the time. Nikola Tesla predicted that everybody would have an automobile, but he didn't predict how it would happen. What is it that does this? So we've predicted for a long time we're going to have a much more automated system. There's going to be manufacturing here, but it's not going to require a lot of people. But what makes that transition? What is the thing that takes us off of the easy labor of China? Because at some point that easy labor is going to be more and more and more expensive. Well, this may not be the thing, but it very well could be the thing that does it for us. I think
it will be the thing. I really do.
I think the transition is going to take multiple years, and I keep getting shocked responses to that statement. Why don't we just do it now? Is a common thing. And do you mind?
We don't have the capability.
Yeah. Do you mind if I just take a moment and explain? I had this conversation with my wife, and she was very appreciative of it. So Abbott Labs just came out with a new test for coronavirus. I'm sure you're aware of this. It's a 5-minute test. The patient can swab their own mouth and stick it in the thing, and the results will come back very quickly. And I was announcing this. I was talking to my wife about it, saying, hey, this just happened. And she said, well, how soon is everybody going to get tested? And I said, well, we really don't know. And she said, what do you mean we don't know? We have the test, right? And then I had to explain the supply chain. And this is a very, very short supply chain, so it's really easier to explain. The kit in question has a series of different chemicals in it that cannot be mixed together until the test is set to go, which means you have, if you're packaging that, to send out to hospitals, particularly if you're packaging lots of that. You have to have a machine that keeps these chemicals separated. Can't use the same nozzle for all the same chemicals. You got to have a different nozzle for each chemical to spray this into the package in the right spot. It's got to hit the right spot in the package to be sealed off in there hermetically so that they don't mix before they're supposed to, which means you have to design the machine that has all these different nozzles in it for all these different chemicals. It's not like you go to Coca-Cola and say, hey, give us one of your spare pieces. You have to custom make a machine. And then you've got to take that prototype and mass produce the machine that's going to be used to mass produce the test. Abbott Labs came out with a test that takes 5 minutes. That's magic. If you had talked to any human in the history of the world about a test that you could just swab the inside of your mouth and know 5 minutes later whether you had a very specific type of virus, that's science fiction. And we're upset because science fiction just became reality, but it's not instant. And what I was saying to her is it's going to take a while to get the equipment together to make the equipment to make the test kit. And in the meantime, it's probably being made by hand or with just a very few prototypes actually working. And it's going to get ramped up. Go ahead.
There's another aspect of it. These chemicals are esoteric chemicals And unfortunately, in many cases, the chemicals from which these chemicals are made are only produced in China.
Yeah. Or some of them are produced here, and some are produced in China, and some are produced in India.
Yeah.
And how do you get them in the right quantity from all the places that we get them so that we can begin making them in mass? And that's the supply chain issue. Let me do a real quick flip to something that is very real and apparent. You know, if you go to a grocery store right now, the majority of the grocery store will be full. There's going to be milk, there's going to be eggs, there's going to be produce. But they're still putting a limitation on how many eggs you can take or how many gallons of milk you can take. And at the same time, this is going to be one of those, what? How is this happening? A whole series of dairy cooperatives, including Land of Lakes and a lot of little ones that most people have never heard of, are telling their farmer members, their dairy farmer members, to dump milk because they don't have the capacity to ship it properly. And on the surface, that sounds absolutely absurd. We have a shortage in the store. They're saying you can't take more than a certain amount. And on the other end, at the dairy farmer level, they are literally dumping the milk into the ground. Well, why? Well, the reason is because the supply chain was geared up to send a bunch of stuff to grocery stores, but also a very large quantity of food to restaurants. Those restaurants are not accepting the food anymore. And if you think of, this is a good one, there's a brand here, Land O'Lakes. If you're sitting at a restaurant and on the table you have these little Land O'Lakes cut out, pre-ready to put on your bread, foil-wrapped patties of butter. Well, here's a newsflash. Most people don't buy butter packaged that way for their house. So if you go back to the Land O'Lakes warehouses and factories that they do the processing to get this stuff sent out, a huge section is devoted to individually wrapping little patties of butter. They don't have the ability to ramp up the other production line into overdrive because so much of the floor space is taken up with restaurant needs. And if you think about things like Welch's, and when was the last time you got your little one serving size jar of jam at the grocery store? So we're seeing a shift in the supply chain, and this is something that we said in the newsletter that I think needs to be put in bold and underlined. The big thing about the supply chain in the future will not rest entirely on its price, but also on its resiliency. How quick will it be to shift our line from doing little patties of butter to doing tubs of butter? How quickly do we go from milk from one spot to another? And the same thing on the hospital side. There are networks in place. There are law-mandated networks amongst hospitals. I think the law that is the broadest, it's called ASPR. And it set up networks of donation locations for hospitals so that if a hospital was in high demand case where they needed something, they could turn to the network and another hospital that didn't have that in high demand, they didn't need it as much, would put it back into that network. And it used to be incentivized by the funding for preparedness from the federal government would flow through that network. And if you didn't donate, you didn't get the funding. Well, that funding's been cut. So there's not been an incentive to use the network. So now if anybody is familiar with behavioral psychology and behavioral finance, it's the prisoner's dilemma. All it takes is one hospital and the network giving a false need. So ahead of the emergency, they say, hey, we're going to have a big demand for ventilators. We need 1,500 of them post-haste when they don't have any cases yet. Well, then nobody's going to donate to the network anymore. Because we have a law-backed network, but it was voluntary. We have the voluntary with funding base, but no there was a carrot, no stick, and the carrot's been removed, and nobody's put a stick in there. This is one of the things that's going to change in the future, is that in order for us to be prepared for emergencies, the hospitals have to trust each other that they're not lying to each other about their needs. They do not trust each other right now. There is not a great deal of cooperation between the hospitals. And the reason is because right now the setup is every hospital for itself. Your responsibility in your network is to get your own stuff. And so there's a scramble of acrimony of hospitals pointing fingers at each other. This is one of those areas where the governor and the president have the ability to step in and mandate some things that are already in the law. To say, this is what needs to happen, and you must report. And if you report in a way that overemphasizes your need above what it actually is, it's a form of fraud. But that's not been instituted. So there's a lot that's going to change out of this for preparedness. There's a lot that's going to change out of this for resiliency, so that we will be much better able to switch our supply chains, shorter supply chains with more capability. Do you have any more specifics on the subject?
I just been fascinated by listening to you. I think among the changes, and a lot of our listeners may not like this, but one of the issues is the federal government, the president has just stated that the federal government will pay for health care for the people who don't have health insurance for coronavirus.
Yeah. But there's no law saying it.
There's no law, but we've got a precedent now.
Well, the president has said they would, but he doesn't have control of the purse strings.
Well, he does. There's a certain amount of money that was given to support hospitals, and the Secretary of the Treasury is the guy who is going to determine how that goes out. And the guy who's the overseeing that is the person, is the White House. He just nominated to be the oversight person. The head of the oversight agency for all this money that's going to be spent is a White House attorney. So we got the system is there. It's like TARP when it first came out.
Okay.
The president and the secretary of the treasury have a great deal of latitude of what to do with a big chunk of this $200 million, or this $2 trillion rather. The issue is, okay, I and you, Jake, pay a lot of money every month for health insurance.
Yep.
So if we get sick from coronavirus, the insurance company pays for it because we paid for it.
Yep.
So the people who don't have health insurance get paid for by the federal government.
Yep.
Now, we've got to see, well, how about if that same person comes in and in the process of treating their coronavirus, they discover they have cancer? Who pays for that? And the answer is nobody.
Nobody.
Well, nobody. And nobody is the people who are already paying insurance. Oddly enough, and I think given the president's disapproval of any form of collective governmental support for health insurance, he just instituted the first universal health insurance program in the history of the United States.
That's true.
We now have a federal guarantee of payment for treating a specific disease. Well, wait a minute. What happens if somebody has another disease and they're about to die? And how do we handle that? Do we say that, okay, if you're going to die from coronavirus, we'll pay for it. If you're not going to die from coronavirus, we're not going to treat you, or we're going to charge you $100,000.
Right. This is the beginning of a big set of questions we don't know the answer to yet. We're not, and this is something we need to make clear. There's nothing wrong with what the president said there. In fact, he's taking a step.
I'm just saying.
The average cost to date coming out of New York City is $29,000 for a treatment of coronavirus. Now, coronavirus in New York is at a level that most of the treatment is taking place at relatively high levels of critical care, which is much more expensive. But just thinking of a $29,000 medical bill, you can understand why we've got some issues here. We've got some problems that need to be fixed. The cost there of the medical care, $29,000 for a couple of weeks of treatment, we've just come to that's what we expect. Because the competition amongst hospitals is very low. You don't get people going, well, which emergency room should I go to visit? you don't get that downward force on prices that competition brings, but we're still technically calling it capitalism. And to some extent, if you're going to do elective stuff, then you're going to go to the one that you like the most. But most often, that's the one your insurance coverage is for. So there's a lot that's going to change on this side. I don't know how yet. Do you have some ideas on what you think are going to come out of this?
Yeah, but they're not. A lot of people aren't going to like them. We're basically going to have the Affordable Care Act with modifications, and the thing that almost got into it in the first place, but it's going to get into it, will be a system of single payer. Basically, you have the option of paying the federal government to provide your health insurance. Because we just provided health insurance for millions of people for a specific disease that's going to affect, depending on which estimates you read, probably at least 40% of the population will have it. And a big piece of that, 20% or so, are going to require some form of hospitalization. And it's going to come in a massive expanse. We don't have enough money to cover it in the bill that just passed. The issue coming out of that is we basically have instituted a single payer system for a specific disease, but we're not charging people any premiums for it.
Yeah.
And once you institute something like that, and let's just say, for example, the coronavirus goes on for a year, which I think it will, probably at least through the end of this year. There will be a lot of people who show up at the hospital saying, who show up and saying, I have coronavirus, and turns out they have the coronavirus. And by the way, some of the projections, we're talking about millions and millions of people showing up at the hospital. The most conservative projections even are saying that. And the federal government is going to wind up paying for an awful lot of those. We set a precedent, and it's a precedent that I think may be a good one, because, and there's a reason for that other than just the humanity of taking care of those people, not saying, well, you don't have health insurance, so go die someplace, which we're not going to do. And then there's laws against that. But more than that, it is in everybody else's best interest that we take care of those people so they're not wandering around spreading the coronavirus, A, and B, their treatment doesn't wind up increasing the cost for the hospitals to the point where they have to raise their charges so much for the people who are insured that it makes insurance unaffordable for the rest of us. This is one of those little things that the more I think about it, the more complex it gets and the bigger the changes that come out on the other side, because we're not going to spend, let's just be very conservative. I'm going to be very conservative here. And you take the number of people who don't have insurance times 29,000, and times the percentage of them are going to wind up in the hospital, and you wind up with some really, really big numbers, and they're doing this without having to pay for it. And that's going to cause a backlash saying, well, they should be, if you're not going to have health insurance, then you need to basically go back. Not that you're going to be charged $95 a year on your taxes for not having health insurance. I think what we'll go back to is a situation saying, if you don't have health insurance commercially, you're going to have to get it through the government, and here's what you're going to pay for it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that.
It's not a matter of socialism. It's a matter of fiscal policy. Be giving away health insurance for free.
Let me lay this as, it is a matter of socialism. It's just, you got to recognize the socialism that already exists. This is something we talked about when the Affordable Care Act was written. People were talking about it's socializing medicine. And I have to go back and say, no, it isn't. It was already socialized, and people gasp at that. We have laws on the books. The vast, vast majority of hospitals in the United States are not-for-profit hospitals. There's a law on the books that says if you are a not-for-profit trauma center, emergency room, and someone shows up with no ability to pay or no known ability to pay, but they are in imminent danger, you must treat them. Who's paying for that? Well, the law doesn't say. Well, maybe you can charge it to Medicaid. Maybe it's a Medicare thing. But most likely, it's nobody pays for it. Because if they're not already signed up for Medicaid, Medicaid's not going to step in and say, oh yeah, this is owed back to the hospital. Not without a lot of fight. So we already had a socialism system without any method of paying for it. We were just resting it on the hospital. The hospital then turned and raised the prices for everyone else on their insurance. So the prices for all of the different treatments went up because a pretty significant portion of the people couldn't pay for it. So the price went up for everybody else, which makes a larger percentage unable to pay for it, which causes the prices to go up higher for those that can again and again and again, and that's what we've seen. So what we've just...
And that's why we're paying $1,500 a month per family for health insurance.
Right, exactly. So what part of that is not socialism? What we've just described is redistribution of wealth. It was under a capitalistic mandate, but with a governmental mandate saying you got to treat anyway. So we have to first recognize that the system of socialized medicine was already in place. And you can't put capitalism on top of socialism without causing the prices to get astronomical. It's just not possible. You cannot enforce competition between hospitals when they have to take a patient or the patient has no choice on where they go. That's caused capitalism to not work, and it's caused socialism to not work here. So there are places in the world where socialized medicine has worked really well, and places where it's worked really, really poorly. To date, there's not really a capitalistic form of healthcare anywhere on the planet except for maybe Africa. And people get shocked at that. Well, no, the United States has a capitalistic medicine system. No, it doesn't. If the largest negotiator at the table is Medicare, so if you're in a co-op, let's say, we'll go back to the dairy farmer, and you're negotiating as a group to try to get a specific price on your milk, and the largest farmer in the group says, I don't care, I'll take whatever they want. Well, it's
just Saudi Arabia in the oil market.
Right, Saudi Arabia in the oil market or Medicare in the medicine market. When you have the very largest player on the field that does not negotiate, how is that a capitalistic? You've just destroyed capitalism for the smaller players. So they just say, fine, we'll take that as well. Whatever that is, we can't go below that, so we're going to take Medicare prices. If we negotiate it, we're certainly not going to tell the other hospitals around us what deal we got, because we may lose the deal if we do it that way. So this is a bunch of not-for-profit hospitals that have been incentivized to not share with each other what deal they've got. Now, if this were capitalism, first off, the hospital would be for profit. It would be saying, all right, I'm going to provide treatment, and this is the pay I'm going to get. And in the sector of the healthcare market that is for profit, quality has gone up over the last two decades, and the prices have gone down. This is Jake, you just said capitalism wasn't in U.S. medicine. Elective surgeries, LASIK eye surgery, tummy tucks, nose jobs. You go down the list of elective surgeries. Complications have dropped by about half over the last decade, and price has dropped by about half over the last decade. Every other part of medicine has doubled over the last decade. That's not an exaggeration. Look up the prices. People have been saying, man, healthcare is getting expensive. Yes, it has gotten very expensive. So we don't have capitalism in our medicine except in very, very limited areas, and those seem to work fairly well. But when you are in the process of having a major heart attack, you're not calling and checking prices at all of the local hospitals or deciding that you're going to fly to another state in the process of having your heart attack to get the right treatment. That's what we're dealing with here. This is a situation that needs some more scrutiny. There is not an easy answer, but the answer that comes out of it should be well thought out, and this is the problem with the Affordable Care Act. The Democrats wrote it without any Republican input. We almost did that again on the Republican side with the coronavirus stimulus package. It started out being no input from the Democrats. It got stalled up, and that was part of the reason it got stalled up. But now we have a bipartisan bill, and this is the first one that's been unanimously bipartisan. The Secure Act was in there. This one, they're dealing with finances and emergencies, but now the next step is how do we fix it so that it doesn't keep happening? How do we fix the healthcare system in general? And I don't mean Medicare for all, because Medicare is broken. We're gonna have to get together. There are good ideas on the Democrat side, and there's good ideas on the Republican side. We can take systems that already work and privatize them rather than having them be public. And when I say privatize and public, go ahead. What did you say?
Speaking of systems that work and don't work, it's coming up on commercial time, I thought I'd tell you that.
Yes, thank you. Right now, a not-for-profit hospital. Who owns a not-for-profit? This is one of those things that most people are not aware of. They're community-owned. Not-for-profits do not have share owners. They are a community-owned organization. So think about the word community and the word communism. It's the same meaning. A not-for-profit hospital is a communist with volunteer donation available hospital that's trying to run in a capitalistic way. And that's the nitty-gritty. That's getting it right down to when people say, I don't want socialized medicine, or I want it to stay capitalistic. It's going to have to change to be capitalistic. It will not have to change very much to be totally socialism. What's the solution? Well, we need to get out there and really start brainstorming correctly across the aisle rather than having a tug-of-war match. And we do have commercials to play. So I'm going to play some commercials. I'll be back. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. I was going to say the number to call in, but the line is full. So we'll be back on the other side.
We need to say that I'm calling in on the line, and as a result, you can't call in on the line, so we're not taking telephone calls. We are taking emails at either jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com.
That's right, and that's favoritism for you. We've got a favored caller, and you guys can't. Nah. All right, we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and...
Jeff.
I was saying your name. Jake and Jeff McClure.
Jeff.
Yes, I said your name as if it was me. See, when people talk about, why are you guys so proud about saying your own names on the air? This is why. It's hard.
It's hard. It is. It's hard, particularly when we're operating one of us someplace else, and it's probably going through satellites and into space and back again.
Right. There's all these buttons on this board I've got to be hitting and talking at the same time. Man, I'm glad I don't chew bubble gum. This would be complicated.
Yeah, it would be. Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and unfortunately, I'm filling up the telephone line that comes in. You want to pester the radio station during the week and tell them that they really need to get the other telephone line back functioning on this board. It's not. So that I can call in and you can call in, too. You're welcome to pester them.
Yes.
But meanwhile, back at the ranch, you just got to listen to us and think about, again, you're welcome to email us at either jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Give us an email, and we will treat it like you called in on the air. We talked about one tiny aspect, and I mean it's tiny compared with everything else that's going to change.
Right.
The fact that healthcare is going to be turned on its ear. Among other things, the hospitals right now are in great financial stress. I mean, across the country, there have been several articles on it, but more importantly, we've gotten anecdotal reports from people who are getting laid off. Now, this last unemployment report It just came out, the ISAY unemployment report, that was 700. The monthly unemployment report is almost meaningless because it's basically captured data before the 14th of March. But the weekly layoffs, when we went down to the major industries that were laying people off, one of the major industries laying people off is healthcare.
Yeah.
And why are they laying people off? Because the hospitals are empty. Their census, as they call it, their bed count in the hospitals where the coronavirus hasn't hit yet has dropped down phenomenally to where it's only critical cases.
Yeah, because everybody's shut off.
The world of hurt for finance.
Yeah, if you've got an elective surgery, you're getting a knee replacement done and you wanted to do it sometime this year, you got it scheduled, that's been canceled. All of those have been canceled. If you're a dermatology, you don't have a lot of business right now. And that means people are getting laid off. In healthcare,
the clinics are basically emptying. We're hearing about hospitals shutting their clinics down because nobody's coming in. Practically nobody is coming into the clinics because they're afraid they'll get the coronavirus by coming into the clinics. They think they'll be full of sick people. There are several hospitals that the Wall Street Journal reported on, just anecdotally, because there's no central database for this, that are on the verge of bankruptcy. Even when the coronavirus cases surge, it's going to take the government a while to pay, and the rest of the hospital system is not working. There's nobody coming in for all the other stuff. So you wind up with a hospital full of extra people to take care of coronavirus patients and no money coming in because there's no system set up at present for the government to pay the hospitals. It's kind of like if you're a small business and you're applying for the Payroll Protection Loan and the CARES Act, you probably already discovered that the banks don't know how to make the loan. They're trying to figure out how to do it because the bill wasn't particularly clear and the Treasury issued some initial guidance on how to do it, but they made a mistake of saying, for example, the interest rate, which is only 1%. They didn't say whether it was compound or simple. And there's a world of difference when you set up a computer for a loan and there's no methodology for dealing. What happens if the people don't make the payments? There's so much we don't know that we're unprepared for that it is just almost overwhelming. But the hospitals are laying people off in advance of the coronavirus coming in because they can't afford to keep them and wait for this tidal wave to hit. It's going to hit, by the way. It's going to hit here just like it hit in New York and just like it hit other places. I was talking to a guy in Louisiana, and they're scared. Because apparently people ignored the do not congregate suggestion.
For Mardi Gras.
All it was at the time. For Mardi Gras. And so they think they've got they're seeing an evidence of a mass spread just like they had in Italy.
Yeah.
There's a lot of evidence that this is, by the way, going to go on quite a while. We can talk about that more next hour. We're getting short on time. But there's some massive changes coming. We got a question, by the way, that was emailed in from John.
I've got a question.
Wall Street Journal
as well.
Had an article on debt to pay after the crisis. In the article, they mentioned financial repression. Can you explain it in layman's terms? There's going to be an awful lot of debt unpaid. And I don't mean to the federal government. The federal government can borrow lots of money and without worrying too much about paying it back. The problem is...
Yeah, for now.
the government is asking mortgage companies not to foreclose and rent people who have rentees not to evict the people when they can't pay their rent because they're out of work. So let's just say they don't, but still the debts are accumulating. The bank is on its balance sheet. It ultimately comes back to the banks, and the banks are going to say, you know, we got all this unpaid debt out here. What are we going to do with it? And either the government steps in and says, we're going to forgive all the unpaid debt, which is going to cause a firestorm of opposition. Because how about all the people who did pay on their debts? Or somehow that debt is going to have to be repaid. And this is one of those things we haven't addressed and are probably not going to address until this is over because Congress, the way our system is set up, Congress is going to have to change the law. And in order to change the laws, they have to meet. And in order to meet, they have to congregate. And if they congregate, we'll wind up with a lot fewer congressmen and women. So this is something for which we were so totally unprepared, it is mind-boggling. There's an irony here, though.
What is that?
The irony is the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, required us to be totally prepared for something like that.
Right. And this is something
we disperse and do our business digitally.
When we were on the road here, they'd been requiring it here in Texas, for instance, since 9/11. There's been a you must have an emergency preparedness plan. You need to be ready to do business elsewhere. And then 2 years ago, Harvey hit Houston, and it hit Houston, and everybody's offsite locations were within a block of their main site. So the SEC really, and particularly in the Texas area, the Midwest and Texas, really cracked down and said, hey, you need to have better emergency plans. You need to be able to be working remotely across a large network, not one gathering place within a mile of your main location. And so it forced us to really get on that. That's just, it worked. I think we're not seeing much in the way of major firms unable to respond to their clients for money. It is true in smaller firms, and a lot of financial firms right now are laying off employees in droves, which makes it really hard to contact your financial advisor or your investment advisor. So even being prepared, even having an emergency plan, if that firm didn't have reserves on hand, then they're shutting down. I'm seeing lots of the results of that. So we're going to expect more emergency preparedness in the future. I've got another question by email from Roger. He said, not to interrupt the healthcare discussion, what do you think Russia will do if oil remains at $20 a barrel? Well, this is something...
Go bankrupt?
Yeah, they'll go bankrupt. So will Saudi Arabia. They won't go bankrupt quietly. They're in the process of fighting a proxy war against each other in Yemen. Proxy war on the case of Russia, because their proxy is Iran, who's proxying through the Yemen rebels, while the Saudis' proxies are the former government of Yemen. And they're in full-on hot war battle with each other. This is an extension of that. This oil war that they're fighting, that we're saying, hey, you're going to damage our shale producers, they don't care about the shale producers right now. They have some other very, very strong tendencies. What does Russia do when there's a crisis? It finds an external enemy to blame it on. The same thing is true in Saudi Arabia. So they've got their external enemies now. They've got Saudi to blame or Russia to blame. So long term...
Or they both blame us.
Oh, yeah, or they both blame us. That is the fallback for everyone in the world, is to blame the United States. But the concept here is that it took Germany being bankrupt for Hitler to rise. If you already have a strong man in place when the bankruptcy occurs, you have Mussolini. And Putin is that person. So... coming out of it, he'll have more power than what he started with. And it will be much more of a feudal system than it already is. And it is already a feudal system. So this is one of those areas. We're seeing the spread of democratic feudalism across the planet. It's no longer a communist government in China. Anybody that thinks that isn't aware of the fact that they're making a for-profit enterprises across their entire country. That's not communism. They have a feudal committee instead of a king, and they have a chairman instead of the monarch. That's what they have. It's just different terminology, but this is the same way it works in a lot of Africa, where it's a democratic election. It just so happens to elect the clan chief or the tribe chief that is the son of the last one that they elected and is the grandson of the one they elected before that. There's a feudal system with a minor coating of democracy on it. And that's happened in Turkey and in Russia, in Egypt, in South Africa. It's teetering on the brink of becoming that. So major portions of the planet have moved back toward feudalism after this 80-year gap after World War II. And we can get into the cultural significance of that after this. And we've got to break for commercials or for the hard commercials at the end of the hour. Do you want to have some wrap up for this hour?
Well, we got a call from Tom, and then we can discuss it because it's going to take a little longer than we've got to discuss. But I'd like to discuss it next hour.
Okay.
We got an email message from Tom. I got the message, and it's going to take a little bit of discussion to explain the answer.
Okay. Can you give us a preview of what the question is?
Question is the market report that in our report yesterday, we said we're estimating 1 to 2 million deaths in the models that we've observed that we think are most reasonable, but the presidential press conference says 100 to 240,000 deaths. And there's a very simple explanation for the difference.
Yeah, there's a very simple, but it may take a little bit. Yep. We're about out of time for this hour. If you'd like to call us off the air, we do give fiduciary investment advice to people of high net worth. The local number is
254-947-1111.
And you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There's a contact us form there. You can email us directly at jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com. And if you have questions like this during the week for us to talk about on the radio, we do address them directly on the air from emails that have been sent during the week. Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.